ladies and gentlemen, to another exciting episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live from the fabulously Fukushima-irradiated and fluoridated capital of Auckland, New Zealand, the island-chained nation in the sunny slave South Pacific. It's very nice, and everybody has a part-time job because of the extra UV radiation from the ozone layer hole as a incandescent light bulb. And my very special guest today is the wonderful, the illustrious, the fabulous, even, Paul Carruthers. Paul, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Vinny.
Okay. Now, we're here to talk about Alan Hubbard. And for those of you in the international audience who don't know, Alan Hubbard was a famed financier of the South Island. One of those kind of people that you would think of as one of those good men who would do a deal based on a handshake and expect that a man would keep it his word. And much like a lot of very good business people in this country and many others, those good people have their trust violated by scumbaggery individuals who want to take everything that they have. And precisely that happened to Alan Hubbard. Amid fanfare and much propaganda from the New Zealand government as well as the political left. And Paul was indeed the representative in a lot of ways for Alan's case, even though he was not one of the legal representatives. He was kind of, in a lot of ways, the public face. So, Paul, welcome.
Thanks. The thing with the Alan Hubbard story is that it's so complex that the majority of people have kind of tuned it out because they don't know. Most people won't devote the time to the issues involved to identify what it is that we're on about or why we're upset or how the public have been ripped off, how the taxpayers have been ripped off. Because the story was so convoluted and complex in the end that it's kind of understandable why most people don't understand it. But the bottom line is that that New Zealand taxpayers have been ripped off for more than $1 billion, right, by John Key and his mates. And the problem is for New Zealand is that the vast majority of New Zealanders just haven't connected the dots. You know, they haven't, they're too busy watching the America's Cup or whatever, which is understandable. But at the end of the day, the thing that concerns me is since Alan Hubbard died, we've had the Kim.com saga has blown up. We've had Solid Energy has collapsed and been shown to I'm absolutely convinced that company was stripped of
its assets. Apparently it wasn't so solid.
Exactly. You know, you've had a whole range of things have happened that indicate real shonkiness and wrongdoing on the part of this government and certain officials who are pulling the strings, and nobody's joining the dots. No, I'll give you an example. You haven't seen anybody in the media go back over the timeline and say, well, hang on a minute, John Key said Alan Hubbard was a fraud and therefore that justified using $1 billion of our taxpayer money, right, to sell all of his assets to parties that were related to Key and his mates at fire sale prices. The taxpayer basically had to subsidize the losses. So we had to pay out the banks the difference between what they sold those assets for, right, and what was owed on them to the banks. And Alan Hubbard got the blame for it, but the man never had a trial. Now, since that time, we've watched this whole thing with Kim.com, come into the media, exploded into the media. Everyone's got up in arms about it. It's led to all the GCSB hoo-ha, and everybody's now a lot more aware of just how dodgy John Key is. But nobody, including in the media, has gone back over this timeline and said, hang on a minute, why should we be trusting John Key on what he says about South Canterbury Finance and Alan Hubbard? Right. And that's the thing that concerns me is everybody's just sort of barged on forward and nobody's going back over it and saying, well, look, $1 billion is a lot of money for us to get ripped off by. Why aren't we questioning this? Mm-hmm. I mean, why is nobody questioning the fact, for instance, that they said they needed $1 billion of our money to subsidize the losses? That's the difference between what they sold the assets to their mates for and what they had, we as the taxpayer had to pay out the banks because of what was owing on them, right? Now, Alan Hubbard got the blame for all of that. You know, he's been described as the fraud. And interestingly enough, When he was under investigation, it was all about him. And then as soon as he died, I think about 2 or 3 weeks after he died, all the fraud charges suddenly got shifted across to the 5 other directors. But in the entire time that the investigation into Alan was going on, they never mentioned once anything about these other directors. So how did that happen? They never said these guys were under investigation or anything, and yet within weeks of Alan's death, all the charges, the fraud charges, was shifted sideways onto these guys, and absolutely nobody's questioning it. You guys have all just accepted that it was a finance company director, therefore he's a piece of scum, therefore he doesn't have any rights.
This happened after about 19 different finance companies collapsed, including, Hewlett Wealth Management, who was also co-signed by the National Party aficionado, what was his name, Don Brash, and John Banks. Mr. Hewlett, who actually went to jail because of it, but Don Brash and John Banks, who signed the same documents, didn't.
That's right. That's right. You know, the thing is that I don't want to put Kiwis down, but I will say this. New Zealanders, by and large, are financially illiterate, right? They do not understand how finance companies work. It's pretty straightforward, right? You deposit money with a finance company and they either loan it to other people, right, and get interest on that loan and give you a percentage of that interest as a dividend, right, or they buy an asset like a property and they wait for it to go up in value and that's how you get your dividend another way. The point is this, how a finance company collapses is really simple. Somebody, usually the ones that the money is loaned to, loaned from, for instance, a finance company will borrow money from banks and things like that to finance an asset. So they might put, say, $50,000 into buying a building. They'll borrow the other $50,000 from the bank. So if they start defaulting on those payments at any point, just like you, the bank can come along and say, right, we're going to take that asset back. Now, where it gets tricky is they appoint a third party to come along, like a valuer or something, and say, well, we think it's worth this much now. Now, the problem is there are no controls in New Zealand over who appoints those people or what their qualifications are or whether they have any conflicts of interest or not, and so it goes on. So the point is, in the case of South Canterbury Finance, the banks basically wanted to foreclose on the company and the government helped them do it. And they set Alan Hubbard up as the fall guy for it by describing him as a fraud so they could justify using your money, your taxpayer money, right, to pay out the banks on the difference between what the assets were sold for and what was owed to the banks. I'll give you an example.
Could I interject here? Let's say, for example, you were a ruthless criminal psycho and you had a lot of fingers in many pies around finance. And you saw somebody who was incredibly wealthy, who you thought wouldn't fight back, who was possibly a really easy target, who had an awful lot of money to take off you, and you had a good amount of influence in the media. So you make up something, like let's say he didn't issue a prospectus, when people like that never issue prospectuses on particular finance companies anyway. Then you go in, you get all your mates who are perhaps even working as that person's lawyer or what have you, so that you can split up all of those very, very lucrative assets at fire sale prices. You can scoop it all up for pennies on the dollar, and because you actually have a degree of control over the government and treasury, for example, you can then use taxpayer money to bail out the losses of somebody who wouldn't even make a loss if it wasn't for you stealing all of their stuff.
Absolutely. I'll give you an example. South Canterbury Finance owned a subdivision in Ashburton called Braybrook, right? This is one example of one asset that got sold out in the receivership where taxpayers got utterly ripped off and Alan Hubbard got the blame for it and nobody's asking questions. Now, the Braybrook subdivision was valued at between $6.4 and $8.5 million, right? Now, that means that the lowest valuation at $6.4 was based on a fire sale. They said, if you put it on the market, it'll probably be gone within 3 or 4 weeks and you'll get, at $6.4 million, someone will whip it up real fast. Alternatively, if you're prepared to sit on it for a few months and just see what happens, see which way the wind blows, you can get up to $7.5 to $8.5 million for it if you can bide your time. Now, the South Canterbury Finance owed the Westpac Bank $3.1 million on that property. So bear in mind that the bottom fire sale valuation that was done on it by the receivers was $6.4 million. So in Alan Hubbard's own words, it was a good asset, right? So in other words, if they sold it, rock bottom price at 6.5, they'd still walk away with more than $3 million and be able to pay the Westpac bank out. And that was the case in a lot of the South Canterbury Finance assets were actually solvent like that. They were good assets, right? They were right what they call low-hanging fruit on the tree. This was one example. Now, the receivers sold that subdivision. Now, let's understand this. This subdivision owed Westpac, South Canterbury Finance owed the Westpac Bank $3.1 million on the subdivision.
Who does all the government's banking?
Westpac Bank.
Oh, okay.
The lowest, Westpac Bank was the single biggest benefactor from the taxpayer-funded South Canterbury Finance bailout, right? Mm. Which is interesting because the minister, Simon Power, who made the decision to put South Canterbury Finance into receivership, actually left his job at the end of the last government term and became the head of private banking for Westpac Bank. So if that isn't a conflict of interest, I don't know what is.
Sounds like a minister for justice to me.
Yeah. So the point is that they owed South Canterbury Finance owed the Westpac Bank $3.1 million on this asset. They had the lowest valuation they'd received on it was $6.4 to $6.5 million. They sold it. The receivers sold it to parties who were known to them. Right, that's a related party transaction. Right, which they did not declare. Right, for $1.8 million. Now, there's no justification for that, and if you try and get, and I've got the paperwork, I've seen the paperwork, this is a fact, this is not a conspiracy theory, this is a fact. This subdivision was sold for $1.8 million. So you and me, the taxpayer, were told by John Key that because Alan Hubbard was guilty of fraud, we had to pull $2 million out of our, we had to pull what,
More like $5 million.
$1.5 million out of our pocket to subsidise the losses to Westpac Bank, right, to make sure Westpac Bank got their $3.1 million back while the receivers gave this property away at about one-fifth of its value, one-quarter of its value. And here's the thing. If you go to John Key and Bill English now and say, well, look, sorry, guys, it's not that we mean to mistrust you or anything, but it's just that this guy never had a trial, the guy that you've accused of fraud, because he died 3 days before he even got into a courtroom to prove himself innocent. Right. So it's not that we don't want to take your word for it. It's just that could we just have, I don't know, a little inquiry into South Canterbury Finance so we can just see for ourselves that you're telling us the truth. I mean, after all, John, if you've got nothing to hide, you've got nothing to lose. Mm-hmm. Right. So, no, we can't have that inquiry, Bill English tells us, because the sale of the assets, the sales of all the assets is commercially sensitive. Well, Kiwis, how can you sit back and swallow that? If the sale of the assets is commercially sensitive, right, how come taxpayer money was used? If taxpayer money was used, your and my money was used to subsidise the losses, why aren't we entitled to know what those assets were sold for and, just as importantly, who they were sold to and, just as importantly, how much commission was made out of it?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'll give you another example of finance companies, nothing to do with South Canterbury Finance, of how the public just gets so ripped off by their own misunderstanding about how it all works, right? Bridgecorp. We all remember Rob Petrusevich and all those guys, the guys everybody loved to hate, right? Now, I'm not saying these guys were innocent. They were totally different case to Alan Hubbard.
What about for the international listeners, maybe bring them up to speed just quickly?
Bridgecorp is a finance company that collapsed owing $400-something million to mum and dad investors in New Zealand. And again, it was another case where the people that Bridgecorp's creditors basically foreclosed on it. Somebody came along and drew a line in the sand and said, well, you know, all the assets that you've borrowed money to buy here are all too leveraged. They're not worth what you owe on them. So we're going to call in the debt, basically. And this is the problem. You don't actually get to have any say. The investors never got to have any say in what the assets were valued at. And I'll give you one example. This is after Petrusevich and all those guys are in jail, and the receivers are still winding the company up and selling the assets, right? Petrusevich owned a boat called the Medici, right? Now, it was valued, when he bought it, he paid $1.5, $1.6 million for it. The boat was valued, fire sale, get rid of it, no questions asked, somewhere between $800 and $1 million, right? But say $1 million, sitting down at Westhaven, this thing, great big floating gin palace, right? Okay. The receivers sold that boat to a person that a friend of theirs, and that's been proven because a Herald article uncovered it. They sold that boat to a friend of theirs for $533,000, including GST, and they pocketed $257,000 in commission for themselves, which returned, what, $500,000+ to the investors. $250,000+ to the investors on a boat that was worth $1 million. And nobody asked any questions. So Rob Petricevich and his mates are in jail, and the receivers are basically giving away the assets scot-free to their mates. They're supposed to be helping the investors get their money back, and they're giving the lollies away to their mates at next to nothing, and nobody's asking any questions.
And we'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen. Paul Carruthers is my very special guest for the next 2 hours. The caller line is open, 218-339-8525 is the number to call. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. It's the lighter side of genocide, because in a world so full of chaos and madness, if you lose your sense of humour, you go friggin' nuts! And my very special guest is Paul Carruthers. Now, we wanted to move on a little bit from South Canterbury finance and cover a big wide range of issues, because there's a lot of changes amidst the country right now, particularly change of leadership for Labor. There's some people talking about the very first Greens coalition-led government and so on and so forth. However, unfortunately, as far as I'm concerned, there's not a whole lot of change that we've really ever seen in this country based upon the political leadership strata. It all just seems to wind up benefiting the banks and the corporate scum that run and own the country in the first place anyway.
If any of you people out there are still caught up in this Labor national paradigm, this right-left paradigm, give it up. Right, just give it up, because it's never going to work. It's really frustrating watching all of these people. It appears to me that very few people want to take responsibility for their lives. What they want is somebody to make all the decisions so they can blame them when things don't go the way they want. And so what we do is we keep deifying these people and elevating them to positions, giving them credit that they haven't actually earned. And elevating them to positions that they're not actually suitable for, basically. David Cunliffe's a classic example. I mean, if anybody thinks you're going to get anything different with David Cunliffe running this country than what you get with John Key, you're absolutely dreaming. It's just not going to happen. Let me tell you a story about David Cunliffe, right? David Cunliffe came to Alan Hubbard's house, or in fact, he came to Alan Hubbard's doctor's house one day for a meeting that he arranged with Alan Hubbard so that he could come and get a whole lot of paperwork to take away and try and embarrass John Key in Parliament with, right? Now, that was in the very early days of the investigation into Alan Hubbard. Now, I had set up a database of Alan Hubbard's investors where I had around about 225 or so of them on an email database so that I could keep them in touch with what was going on, because in our campaign to lobby the government to get justice for Alan and to, you know, draw attention to what John Key and his mates were doing with the South Canterbury Finance and all the assets, we ran up over 7,000 emails lobbying the government. So we had Alan Hubbard's investors involved in that all the way along on an email list. Now, I sent an email to those investors that night and said, David Cunliffe's just been to Alan Hubbard's place, has just met with Alan Hubbard and taken away a whole lot of paperwork. So good news, he's going to stand up in Parliament apparently and have a bit of a go. The next morning, when I was driving back from Timaru to Christchurch, my car phone went and it was David Cunliffe. And he was angry as. And he had a go at me on the phone for daring to mention his name in an email to Alan Hubbard's investors. And I asked him why he was upset. And all he was worried about was that John Key was going to get hold of the fact, or the National Party was going to get hold of the fact that he that Cunliffe had been to visit Alan Hubbard, and they were going to embarrass him in Parliament with it. So no regard for the fact that $1 billion of your and my money was going up in smoke in the process. No regard for the fact that the investigations into Alan Hubbard were unlawful, and David Cunliffe knew it and didn't want to do a thing about it, right? It was all about appearance, right? Everything David Cunliffe is doing is about appearance. It's about how it appears to you in spite of what's actually going on. So if you genuinely believe, right, that you're going to get a different or better outcome with David Cunliffe running the Labor Party than you have with John Key running the National Party in control of this country, you are absolutely deluded. I can absolutely promise you, because I've witnessed firsthand how that guy operates, and he is a flake, right?
I was thinking about the connections here. So we've got John Key is the MP of Helensville, southwest, and he lives in Parnell, which is one of the swankiest suburbs in central Auckland. And then you have David Cunliffe, who's the MP of Newlyn, which is out west, and he lives in Herne Bay, one of the swankiest central suburbs in Auckland. And people think that a Harvard-educated man is somehow in charge of a party that's all for the poor working man.
Yeah, you people have been had. You just got to look at the voting record within Labor. Look at it. Look, within Labor, the own caucus, this is the people who work with these guys every day. Hardly anybody supported David Cunliffe, right? The only ones who did support him, if you look at their profiles, they're all clinging on by their fingernails, basically. That none of them actually do anything that's worthwhile. They'd all be out of Parliament a long time ago if people really knew how much they didn't do. The ones who really, probably what I would describe as the better MPs and the more seasoned ones all supported Grant Robertson. So what does that tell you, right? These people actually work with these two guys. And hardly any of them supported David Cunliffe. Where Cunliffe got his support was from the unions and the people outside the Labor Party hierarchy. That's the ordinary people out on the streets. And I'll tell you why it happened, because you had people like Duncan Garner and all the other media, high-profile media people pushing for Cunliffe. Oh, you know, all the rhetoric, oh, New Zealand's not ready for a gay prime minister. Well, everyone I spoke to said wouldn't make any difference to them, but you had all these high-profile people saying New Zealand's not ready for a gay prime minister, New Zealand's not ready for this, New Zealand's not ready for that. Dave, it's going to have to be David Cunliffe.
Who decides what New Zealanders are ready for? The media, apparently.
That's right, and it's just like the way the National Party won the last election, right? They had everybody in the media, all the big noters and the big voices, just shouting everybody else down and telling everybody. It should actually be illegal for anybody in the mainstream media to go on national television or national radio, right, before an election, within a certain time period leading up to election, and say something like, it's a foregone conclusion, National's going to win it, end of story, don't bother thinking anything else. They shouldn't be allowed to do that. What's the point in having elections if you're going to have all these people pushing this agenda like there's no tomorrow? I mean, it's different to politicians actually standing up and saying, here's my policies, this is what I stand for. That's not the same thing. But when you get the likes of Paul Holmes and Paul Henry and all these other tossers, the Duncan Garners of this world, right, using their public platforms to go, I support National and you're an idiot if you don't, right, or, you know, New Zealand's not ready for a gay prime minister. You know, it has to be Cunliffe because it's a fait accompli. We've got no choice in the matter.
At the same time, most of those guys work for MediaWorks, whose former CEO is now the communications minister for National, who brokered a deal to bail them out $30 million in unpaid broadcasting license fees and gave the prime minister an hour of time to speak to the public, called the Prime Minister's Hour, in the height of election season when it was illegal to do that if he was talking about politics.
Yep.
But they said, oh, he's not going to talk about politics. He's going to talk about Coronation Street and his cat as the Prime Minister of New Zealand.
There's too many people turning a blind eye to the rules being broken left, right and centre on the way the media operates in this country. And the media has become almost like a slot machine, you know, like you push a button and it just does something you want. It's become like a slot machine for political parties. And
it's almost like a fortune teller that you give money to and they read your palm and tell you what they want to hear.
Yeah, vote for this or vote for this party or you'll die. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's like, yeah.
So what I'm saying is that everything, you know, the agenda that they want to happen just keeps getting pushed, insidiously pushed in your face. And you end up sitting there going, oh, well, you know, maybe what's the point fighting it? Because everybody else appears to be talking the same way and thinking the same way, so I'll just go along with it, you know? And this is how it happens. I mean, I don't think it should have been a foregone conclusion that David Cunliffe ended up leading the Labour Party. I honestly don't.
It was for me, because I just saw him. He's the only person with a high enough public profile to basically make it that wasn't had that high profile because he bought porn on his credit card.
Well, no, that was Shane Jones.
I know.
Okay. That's true, actually, now you put it that way. But, I mean, here's the point. When you got the likes of Duncan Garner and Martin Bradbury, who I just, God, a man just gives me brain damage. I can't stand him. But Martin Bradbury and those guys, they're out there pushing it constantly. They're trying to convince you that this whole paradigm of left or right, Labour versus National, that somehow if you support one over the other, you'll get a better outcome in your own life. They're deluding you. Those people are dreaming. It's not going to happen. It hasn't happened in how many decades? What makes you think it's going to happen now, right?
What's changed? What's now so radically different with the country that the two mainstream parties have lied consistently and totally betrayed the country every single time that they elected? What's so radically different now? The answer is freaking nothing.
I tell you who's starting a political party in this country that's worth watching, Kim.com.
Uh-huh.
And I'll tell you why. Wait until you see the policies he brings out. Anyone who knows anything about what's good for this country would support him straight away on his stated intention around the IMF for a start. He's already hinted, I've seen it on Facebook, he's already hinted that he wants to take New Zealand down the same road as Iceland and Hungary. And if he does that, I'll back him 110,000%. I'll be out there with a megaphone supporting the man because it is the right thing to do for this country. David Cunliffe is working for the same bankers that John Key basically answers to. So why you would think that you are going to get a different outcome is just beyond me. I mean, I think that's why Shearer gave up, because I think he had a crisis of conscience. I think he knew. I think David Shearer is actually probably a decent guy who just figured out in the end that he couldn't win no matter how hard he tried.
Did you hear about his promotion of mercenary forces in Northern Africa while he was working at the UN?
No. I mean, I'm happy to be wrong about him. What?
Yeah, see, when he was in the UN, he titled a big report, a document. There's a whole lot of sort of what they call politically unstable regions in Northern Africa, Sudan, Nigeria, so on and so forth. There's a lot of US and foreign interests that are in there. But in order to send your army in there, it would be really politically risky, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So Shearer was the author of a document encouraging the use of private mercenary forces in order to settle the West's conflicts in places where it would be a little bit politically risky to send in their own troops.
Right. Okay. So he's obviously not that.
see, it's the problem. That's why I call the universe fractal scumbaggery, because it's a repeating pattern. For every instance of scumbaggery that you look into, there's a whole new world of scumbaggery that comes into light. And then each one, a little bit of that you look into, a whole new world comes to light.
Yeah.
And it's a real problem with this country is that we have a media that doesn't interview people, say, like yourself, for example, in long form. I was watching the news last night, Paul, and I saw these protesters outside protesting against deep sea oil and so on and so forth. And I was just thinking to myself, you know how much airtime they actually gave somebody time to express their views? It was about 4.5 seconds.
Yeah.
They got time to have one sentence.
Yeah.
You have any idea how much information you can cram into a single sentence?
Yeah.
Frack all.
Yeah. I mean, this is what happens when you watch the mainstream news, basically. What they do is they tell the story the way they want you to hear it and they want you to understand it. And then they get somebody to either, basically they just get somebody to 4.5 seconds to provide the proof that everything they just said to you is right, okay? And it just goes on and on and on, and nobody asks any questions. I'll give you another example about Cunliffe, right, of how people just get, how people become myopic, you know, just blinkered to the point where they don't see what's really going on. David Cunliffe was the Labour, I think, finance associate minister or something. Finance spokesperson or something under the last Labour government. Or he had a finance. He was involved with the finance portfolio somehow. The bottom line is, dozens and dozens of finance company finance companies collapsed on Labor's watch prior to John Key getting into power in 2008, right? Now, it was totally unregulated. The New Zealand market was virtually unregulated. The Companies Office never did anything to stop it. The Securities Commission was completely useless. None of them actually did anything to control or regulate finance companies. They all just took a completely passive approach. So there's dozens of finance companies just tipped over on David Cunliffe's watch, right? And then John Key comes in and says, don't worry, New Zealand, I'm going to save you from all these bad finance company people.
I used to work at one called the Federal Reserve.
Yeah, I'm going to save you from people like me, you know what I mean? And I'm going to use your money to do it, and you're going to love me for it, and you're going to thank me. You're going to thank me for sticking it to this 84-year-old man who's getting dialysis because he's the archenemy of New Zealand. He ran this finance company, right, that I have to use your money to bail out now because of his fraud. And we don't have to worry about little details like, oh, I don't know, a fair and proper investigation into him. I mean, you know, we'll just announce that he's a fraud before we even start the investigation. And because you people are also desperate to hang a finance company director, any finance company director, you'll swallow it hook, line and sinker and you won't ask any questions. And guess what, New Zealand public? That's exactly what you did. I mean,
and they did thank him for it as well. I go out protesting and stuff like that, like on Pukekohe, and have people wind down their windows. There's only one thing I've got to say about John Key, mate. Thank you. Like, seriously.
Yeah. You know, this is the thing, is that your sort of gut need to hang a finance company director, John Key needed you people to be angry with all these finance company directors so you'd turn a blind eye to the way he was doing it. I mean, none of you ever asked, like, how can they accuse someone of fraud before they've even started the investigation, right? I mean,
why do you think they use the Serious Fraud Office, mate? Because they're the ones that run most of the serious frauds.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it was really interesting hearing one of Alan Hubbard's lawyers describing the guy that ran the Serious Fraud Office what did he describe as an arrogant little git? I had a real giggle over that. But the thing is that you people have been completely and utterly diddled because your own need to hate somebody has been manipulated and played on.
Mm. Well, you know what they say, you can keep everybody afraid, and all of a sudden their reasoning process and their ability to question and clicks off, and you can get them to do whatever you want. We'll be right back after the break at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. Paul Carruthers is my guest.
Come gather around, people, wherever you roam, and admit that the waters around
welcome back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. You know, it's interesting. What was his name? Bob Dylan said the times they are changing, and unfortunately, the regime and control of New Zealand, i.e., the bankers, that ain't. All right, Paul Carruthers is my very special guest. Now, we've talked about the Labour leaders, we've talked about the Alan Hubbard debacle. Where would you like to go next, or would you like to stay on this kind of leadership thing?
Yeah, I do, because I want to talk about how I'll give you an example of how Cunliffe, how I don't think you can expect anything different out of him. So this guy went to Alan Hubbard's house and then basically, you know, tried to get information that he thought he might be able to hang John Key in Parliament with, but then had a complete meltdown and a panic attack when I notified Alan Hubbard's investors that he'd done that. Because I asked him, I said, what are you worried about, David? You can imagine I'm driving along, right, I was on Bluetooth, but I was driving along in my car, got David Cunliffe having a go at me down the phone, and I'm going, David, what's your problem? What are you worried about? Why are you so worried that I told Alan Hubbard's investors you went there and got some information and that you're going to stand up for them in Parliament? And he said, oh, because National can get hold of the information and embarrass me with it. Well, what's more important to you, you know?
Well, hold on a second. They're going to embarrass you for seeking out information to hang them with.
Yeah, like here he was there getting information that absolutely, it's been proven in several ways that investigation was unlawful. David Cunliffe knows it. He's been given all of the evidence on a plate, right? David Cunliffe knows the investigations were unlawful. He knows the receivership was a scam. He knows that parties related to the receivers and the decision makers have benefited materially from it at taxpayers' expense. He knows we can't get an inquiry into it because John Key and Bill English are playing secret squirrel. He knows that He knows that they're using terminology like, oh, well, it's the sale of the assets were commercially sensitive. So, you know, even though your taxpayer money was used, it was commercially sensitive. We can't declare who we sold it to or for how much or how much money was lost or what we had to pay out the bank with your money. We can't get any of that information, and yet taxpayer money was used. And have you seen David Cunliffe stand up once and challenge any of this? No. So why do you think he's going to be any better or different? Now, I've heard all the stories from the Martin Bradburys and people like that saying, oh, you know, Alan Hubbard was a fraud. He was Mr. Magoo. You know, trust David Cunliffe. You know, he nobody could stop what was happening. Alan Hubbard was as guilty as sin. And, you know, don't listen to that pork or others. He's an idiot. Well, Alan Hubbard never had a trial. So what Martin Bradbury and David Cunliffe and the rest of them are asking you to do is to basically turn a blind eye to the fact that the justice system was completely left out of this equation.
It was missing in action.
It was completely missing in action. What they're all saying is you've just got to take our word for it that Alan Hubbard was guilty and therefore $1 billion of your money was needed. Now, what I'm saying is I am lumping David Cunliffe in right in there with John Key in terms of liability and culpability for this, and I'll tell you the reason why. Because David Cunliffe has got the power to stop it. David Cunliffe always had the power to stop it, and David Cunliffe never exercised the power to stop it, right? So he's as guilty as you are, and I can absolutely guarantee you he knows enough of the fine details about this subject, right, to know that he could finish John Key by next week with it. And why isn't he doing it?
I smell blackmail.
Yep, no, he's not. I'll tell you why he's not doing it, because he knows that John Key can turn around in Parliament and say, ah, yes, David, but something like 24 finance companies collapsed on your watch. You left us with no choice, right, but to have to step in and act. And guess what? All the no-brain, no-thinkers, all the people with the 4.5-second bloody attention spans out there, what they're going to do is go, yeah, John's right. We needed to be saved from one of these finance company directors, and it doesn't matter if the process was all dodgy about the way they went about it. At the end of the day,
it doesn't matter whether all the money went to John Key and his mates.
Yeah, it doesn't. At the end of the day, Alan Hubbard, old, sick, who cares? We just wanted somebody to go down. So we're not gonna argue with John Key about it. We're not gonna question David Cunliffe about it. We're just gonna accept that it needed to happen. Well,
think about the morality standard. You know, you're going after an elderly man who's on kidney dialysis. Just that by itself.
Yep. I mean, nobody questioned. I got into it because he was 84 years old and getting dialysis. I'm like, what's wrong with you people? The guy's sick. The way a society treats its elderly people and its young people is an indication of where we're at. And I'd say, based on all the evidence I've seen, we're screwed.
I reckon they were probably hoping he'd die of his illness before he'd ever have the chance to fight back.
Alan was due in court 3 days after he was killed, less than 3 days, actually 2.5 days after he was killed. He was due in court to submit all of his evidence to challenge all of the government's actions against him. Now, I know what was in his evidence, and I'll tell you now, that was 5 weeks before the last election, and the evidence that was going to be submitted in court would have found its way into the newspapers the same day, and if that evidence didn't stop the government from winning the last election, it would have severely damaged their chances. They would have certainly lost seats over it because the evidence was overwhelming that the investigations were unlawful and that the government had effectively lied to the New Zealand public, completely misled the New Zealand public. Now, David Cunliffe knows this and he's done nothing about it, right? So they're all guilty of misleading you. I'll absolutely guarantee you that. And if I'm wrong, then I would be happy to be proven wrong by a full judicial inquiry into the South Canterbury Finance Receivership. But what I'm not willing to accept is anybody, David Cunliffe, John Key, or Bill English, or any of their supporters on any side trying to tell me that there shouldn't be an inquiry, or that it doesn't matter that proper process was dispensed with, or that the justice system was completely trashed in this process because it was a finance company director, right? The minute we start going down that road, it's a slippery slope we can't return from, because then what we're doing is we're just hanging people out to dry by media trial. I mean, Judith Collins is very good at it, right? She just litigates everything by media.
So is Paula Bennett.
You know, I'll give an example with the way they do things. David Bain. David Bain spent 13 years in jail. He's effectively been on trial for 20. If you look at the way we carry on in the newspapers and on Facebook and on television, David Bain has effectively been on trial for 20 years. Of those 20 years, he spent 13 of them in jail. But that's not enough for some people, right? They've still got to hang the guy. So when Judith Collins gets presented with an opportunity to offer this guy compensation, or with the question of whether we should offer him compensation or not, she just hangs it out in the media and basically starts a whole new trial. So we're now into, what, the 21st or 22nd year of David Bain's ongoing trial, thanks to a justice minister that actually doesn't want to do her job. And that's the way things are going in this country. What they're doing is they're using the media. When I say there, I'm meaning the political parties. They're using the media to litigate subjects in the public forum that actually belong before the courts. Then what you're finding in this country is that everything that does go to court usually goes against the government. Kim.com's a classic case, right? If Alan Hubbard had gone to court, the whole outcome would have been different. The public would have been alerted to the fact that this whole South Canterbury finance receivership was a scam. But he was killed 3 days before he got to court in a car accident. He wasn't killed in a car accident. He died of a heart attack 2.5 hours after the car accident. But the car accident was the means by which he was put in the position where he lost his life, was the best way I could describe it.
Yeah, well, he was apparently he was laughing and joking with the nurses or whatever. Look, and then they bung him in a helicopter that's like a couple of minutes ride to the hospital that he's going to, and he dies on that ride.
A couple
of days before he's meant to go in court to destroy the national government 5 weeks before the election. Isn't that freaking convenient?
I mean, half of you people would have watched the other driver on Campbell Live several weeks ago, the guy that hit them. There he was on Campbell Live and nobody joined the dots. He said, oh, yeah, I thought it was a bit strange. Yeah, they wheeled him past on the trolley on his way to the helicopter, and he told me, and I had a bit of a chat to him, and he seemed perfectly fine to me. I mean, his widow told me the same thing. Oh, yeah, the last I saw him, they wheeled him past me on the trolley, and he said, oh, they're taking me to Dunedin. And she said to him, oh, well, I'm going there in an ambulance, so I'll see you in a few hours. Oh, yeah, okay, see you later. Half an hour later, he's dead. I mean, no, of a heart attack. And yet, whenever you pick up a newspaper, whenever you read a newspaper, Fairfax is really good at it. They'll say, Alan Hubbard died in a car accident. Alan Hubbard died in a car accident. Alan Hubbard died in a car accident. Every time you read a newspaper, he did not die in a car accident, mm-hmm. right? He was injured in a car accident, but he was laughing and chatting to all of the staff for up to 2 hours after the car accident, and he died of a heart attack when he was airlifted in the helicopter to Dunedin Hospital for surgery. Now,
it's come out in the U.S. Congress. I don't want to get all conspiratorial here, but it does happen that the CIA and DARPA and a number of other agencies have developed weapons that they can use to actually cause heart attacks and be completely undetectable, untraceable. So it's not outside the realms of possibility. I'm not saying that's what happened. But these kind of things happen all the time. Look, intelligence agencies are very ruthless, and they act on behalf of whoever's corrupt. In my experience, you take the unions, for example, the people who kind of voted for David Cunliffe to be the next leader of the Labour Party. I've spoken to a number of former union leaders, and they say that the whole dang structure of them have been completely infiltrated by intel ops and so on and so forth. So there's a whole bunch of complicated things going on here, and the fact that it stinks to high heaven and is highly suspicious, I think, is enough.
I think that, I think what propelled David Cunliffe to the lead of the Labour Party was all the help he got from the Duncan Garners and the Martin Bradburys and all these people that are busy trying to help.
That's all of the above.
Yeah, I mean, all these people are just misleading the public, basically, but there's nothing, I mean, they've got the broadcasting power, you can't stop them. I mean, it's up to you, you people out there, to exercise your individual choice. And exercise, discretion and common sense, and do your research. But look, I'll give you an example, another example of how you've been totally scammed with the South Canterbury Finance Receivership. Now, I'll tell you what, this is a bit complex, so we'll do it after the break, because this is actually really important. I can give you stuff to Google for those of you that care. Go and Google it, and it will prove me right. I will show you exactly the degree to which you were scammed and exactly how you were scammed, and you can Google it very quickly and easily.
All right, we'll get into that after the break. Kyle in Philly, I can see you're on the hold there. The call-in number is 218-339-8525. We'll take your calls after the break. Back in a minute.